welcome to Holistic Matters Podcast. I'm your host, John Tro, and this podcast is designed to help you learn more about becoming the you that nature intended. And to help us develop better insights in how to do that, we're here with clinical nutritionist and author Nicole Magrida. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, John.
Yeah, great. Thanks for joining us. Again, in our first segment, we had a chance to talk about all the issues and challenges that the population is faced with in trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle through nutrition and holistic care. Mm-hmm. And in this section, it would be great to talk a little bit more about your book, Nourish Your Tribe, and some of the recommendations, insights, and advice that that you provide readers. So why did you write the book? Tell us a little bit about how you got to that point and why you thought it was so important to make sure that your book and these insights were available.
Well, they say that all nonfiction, a lot of nonfiction authors write books when they get frustrated enough with something. And I think, I think I could say that's maybe partially true for me. I have spent, the last good part of 20 years working in nutrition science in some format. And I, I've worked in inpatient, outpatient clinics. I've worked in cardiac rehabs. I've worked with school systems to help develop wellness programs. I've worked in corporate wellness where I've implemented health programs for big companies like GE. And I've done a lot of different things. Of course, I talk to parents every day. And when I try and explain, and I think maybe at the time where I was really inspired to write this book was when I was working mostly with the school systems, because I would come across, I was making a lot of these changes, I was revamping their lunch program, and I was conducting a bunch of lectures and bringing professionals in to lecture on all a variety of different topics, and I was always shocked and alarmed at some of the responses that I would get from parents around nutrition. And I think it really inspired me, because I thought, I need to get this message out to parents who are raising, the next generation of children, because there are such important topics. And I'm like, how can I explain, 20 years of my knowledge, and I can't do it in 15 minutes to them, because some of them are not getting really understanding the point. I mean, I did simple things like change lunch programs, and I had parents calling me upset with me because I took, fried foods off the menu, and they would not yell at me, but they would be very upset and say, well, I give my child broccoli at night. They can eat, fried chicken nuggets. They're fine. And they'd be upset with me. So I said, well, I need to do something so that people, if I can, put it all in one place, and I can say, if you just read this, then maybe you can understand why it's so important. Why we need our kids to be optimally nourished and while they're at 6 hours in school, when we want their brains to be working, in the best state possible, why that's so important. So anyway, so I think that's what initially inspired me. And then, of course, just working with, I work with adults and children, but I work in a pediatric clinic, and I just, it breaks my heart to know that there are a lot of these kids that are growing up in this world that has so many challenges from a food perspective. And we can, if we just can collectively get together as a tribe and in our communities, in our schools, in our religious institutions everywhere, and if we can collectively get together and understand this message, then maybe we can get somewhere, because at the rate in which our chronic diseases are increasing in this country, we need to do something, and we need to do something fast. So this is sort of my contribution to the world, to hopefully help parents and empower them to make changes in their homes and in their communities.
Yeah, great. So what are some of the, say, nutritional insights that you just described that are really kind of like the main drivers? For example, is it just a lack of understanding of what the four food groups are, right? I can imagine if you go into most communities that aren't well-versed in good nutrition, if you ask them what the four food groups are, you get a variety of answers, including corn chips, potato chips, fried foods, and sugar beverages, or worse, right? Fast food options.
Yeah.
But is that fundamentally what you think ultimately needs to be changed, just a better awareness of how to select healthier foods?
Well, yes, that's always needed. I see different perspectives. I see I have a lot of patients that have from maybe a lower socioeconomic level that have very, very little knowledge and education when it comes to nutrition. And, you know, a lot of their choices are driven by economics and lack of education, which is very difficult. However, sometimes when I see patients in clinic, if I can just get one message to them, I'll say, because I go over a lot of stuff with people when I talk nutrition, but I usually hone in on one or two things that people can grasp and change in that moment. You know, a big one, and I actually work in with a lot of kids with metabolic syndrome, and the one thing I always say to them is, if you don't remember one thing that I talk about today and you choose to do nothing, the biggest thing that sabotages most kids' diets in that clinic is sugar-sweetened beverages. And I say, if you do anything, you know, try and eliminate those and stop buying them and just drink water. You know, there's a lot of education needed in a lot of different areas. It just really depends. I as I said, I work in the school systems, and, you know, some families are all on board. Some families don't understand why it's so important. And it gets back to, you know, parents don't link their child's issues with food. They don't think it's worth the change. You'd be shocked at, you know, parents that I'll go to lunch with that I don't even know that well, and I'm around them, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, my son has chronic headaches, or my son has anxiety, or my son has GI distress, and I'll say, oh, well, have you thought about changing his diet? And I'll give some suggestions. Like, oh, no, that's too hard. I can't do that. I just don't think people give it, you know, the amount of time and energy like they do all of these other parenting strategies. You know, if we gave as much attention to raising our kids in from a healthy food perspective that we do with all these other parenting goals, like, you know, teaching our kids good manners and teaching our kids to be respectful and good study habits. And, you know, it takes hours a day, every day, to teach your kids some of these things. And if we spent just half of that amount of time focusing on, you know, how do we model good behaviors from a food perspective for our kids, and how do we, you know, feed them well, we would, you know, it's the fundamental tool for survival is their health. But I just don't think a lot of parents see the connection there. I think they're too busy and just don't give it as much attention because they have too many other things going on. And I think the thought of changing a diet, because kids are picky in general, I think the thought of addressing that with a child just makes a parent, you know, it makes them shudder.
Yeah.
Because I think they think it's too overwhelming.
Right. So I guess it's kind of inherent in the title of your book, Nourish Your Tribe, and the key word there, tribe, is that it's not enough to talk to the child. It's not enough to talk to the parent. You got to talk to everybody that's going to be influencing their practices and habits.
Yeah.
That's a heck of a challenge.
Yes,
right?
You do.
How do you do that?
It is. Well, I think that's why I go to schools and I go to community organizations and everywhere that they're going to be exposed to, because I know that as soon as my children leave my doorstep, I know that they will be bombarded with unhealthy messages from a food perspective everywhere they go. No matter if it's school or if it's a soccer game or if it's a birthday party or it's sleeping over at a friend's house or wherever they go, they're going to be bombarded with unhealthy food. I just know that. So I do as much as I possibly can to help parents get on the same page. And if we are speaking the same truth in our communities, then we can hopefully begin to start making some of these changes overall and collectively together.
Yeah. Okay. So in our last segment, we talked a little bit about what the four most important optimal practices are, and these practices mm-hmm. that are more important than what the most important diet is, right? Because if you follow the practice, you'll end up having the right diet. But in that discussion, you describe four important components: is make sure that your food choices are nutrient dense, make sure that they provide really I would describe it as a balanced metabolic control to avoid inflammation. Thirdly, make sure that whatever you eat is going to promote a healthy microbiome. And then the fourth issue mm-hmm. was to help support a balanced and healthy hormone response and control. But can we tease those? Mm-hmm. Can we tease those out? What would be, as you go and talk about the key point of nutrient density, what would you recommend, and what are you recommending for people to be aware of getting better nutrient dense foods?
I'll say that, you know, our bodies require about 40 different micronutrients. for normal metabolic function. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, maximizing nutrient density should be one of our primary goals, right, when we talk about diet, because I think deficiencies of any of these essential nutrients can contribute to a lot of the development of these chronic diseases that we're talking about, as well as a, you know, a shorter lifespan. I don't know how many people get that concept. You know, there, I think it's absolutely possible for, you know, your child's bad mood or brain fog or depression to be caused by nutrient deficiency. So that's why I really stress these nutrient-dense foods. Most parents are unaware that food and nourishment are linked in that fashion. So as I was just talking about before, Dr. Bruce Ames has at Berkeley has a great, he has something called the triage theory. And it sort of explains that we have like this evolutionary adaptation of our bodies that that if our bodies are nutritionally limited in micronutrients, that our bodies sort of ration nutrients in terms of priority. And the body will always direct nutrients towards short-term survival and to be able to reproduce and away from regulating and repairing of DNA and proteins that increase longevity. So what that essentially means is while your body's keeping your functional operations alive, at the cellular level, if you're not giving it what it needs and these optimal micronutrients, that, you know, disease and decay are setting in. So I tell parents all the time, you know, if your child's not, they will say to me, well, you know, Johnny's plotting a nice curve on his growth chart. And I say to them, you know, plotting a curve on your growth chart does not mean that your children are biologically healthy and nutritionally sound. You know, growth by itself does not indicate a strong immune system or a well-functioning brain or even a healthy digestive system. So, for example, you know, a kid that suffers with anxiety and headaches could be missing out on key nutrients like zinc or iron or essential fatty acids, or could even have sensitivities to gluten or dairy. But when it comes to nutrient-dense foods, I think we get different components from both plant foods and animal foods.
Right.
Traditional diets and organ meats, of course, are extremely nutrient dense, loaded with B vitamins and iron and so on and so forth. But aside from that, I think in our day and age, animal foods are extremely nutrient dense. If you're getting quality animal foods, they're loaded with, you know, B12 and heme iron and zinc and A2 and vitamin D and essential fatty acids, DHA and EPA. They have congelated linoleic acid, which is found in ghee and butter and grass-fed meats. And then plant foods sort of give us this other array of nutrients, you know, things like polyphenols and carotenoids and lignans and prebiotic fibers, and the list goes on. So these are really powerful, potent disease fighters that I think are essential. And when I look at an optimal diet, I look at it as a plant-based diet with maybe a little bit of meat in there, because meat's so nutrient dense that you don't need a lot of it. I look at it more as a condiment or a side dish, because plant foods really offer, you know, these really powerful compounds. So as far as nutrient density, it's eating whole foods. It's not eating these processed food-like substances that 60% of Americans are now eating, or they actually consuming it in their diets. If you do anything, you need to start choosing whole foods, because that's where the nutrients are.
Right. Yeah. Great. Okay. What about the next point on you know, avoiding foods that might be promoters of underlying inflammation?
So as I mentioned before, I said if there were three things I'd take out of American diet, it would probably be the refined carbohydrate foods, sugar, and polyunsaturated vegetable oils. Those are three things that are very inflammatory. They're very powerful. They're very, very ubiquitous in our culture, in our food culture. And those, if we could remove those things, we would help really get rid of a lot of the inflammatory response that we see in our bodies.
Yeah, great. The next one was a healthy microbiome. Is that largely coming from fruits and vegetables or quality carbs or what?
Oh, yeah, it's coming from fiber, foods with fiber. So, you know, we get fiber from fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains. So when we're talking about a healthy microbiome, we're talking about fermentable carbohydrates. So these are usually fruits and vegetables in their raw or lightly cooked state. They're things like leeks and onions and garlic and Jerusalem artichokes. And, you know, you can take things like unmodified potato starch is a resistant starch that helps feed the microbiome.
Right.
as well as good grapefruits and vegetables, or other fruits like berries are an awesome one because they have tons of polyphenols in them that support the microbiome. So yeah, it's primarily fruits and vegetables, but really foods with fiber. And we are so lacking with fiber in our diet, the American diet. I recommend, you know, anywhere between 40 and 50 grams of fiber. I think the American Medical Association might recommend somewhere around 25 to 30. But in truth, our diets, most people are getting probably, you know, 10 grams of fiber, very, very little, because we're eating all these processed foods.
Yeah.
So again, leaning more towards the whole diet is going to give you some of these essential nutrients from the microbiome perspective,
right,
as well as probiotic foods, you know, foods that have, that are fermented, like kimchi and kombucha and anything, that all these fermented foods that are out there that support a healthy microbiome. You're actually consuming the probiotics in these foods that they, therefore, when they ride through your intestinal tract, they're supporting your existing microbiome.
Right. Okay. Then the fourth issue was eating foods that at least support a healthy balance of hormone response.
Yeah, it's a healthy hormone balance. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what I like to tell people is, you know, you really want to incorporate quality protein, healthy fat, nutrient-dense whole carbohydrate foods and fiber with all your meals and snacks, for that matter.
Right.
I think it's too often people, like especially with kids that are, you know, leaving out the door quickly for school, and they're grabbing a bar or even an apple or banana, but they're not balancing their meals as far as protein and fat and carbohydrate. They're just eating straight carbohydrates,
right,
which spikes blood sugars, and then they wonder why, you know, they're hungry an hour or two later. So I think balancing blood sugars is just essential when it comes to eating well and eating healthy in general. So I think being able to balance each of these when you're thinking about creating each meal is really, really important.
Yeah, great. Okay, fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your book. How did you lay the book out, and what are the major components or elements of the book, and how you framed your message throughout the book?
I laid it out. So I first sort of introduced, the first chapter is really why nutrition is so important. It's a lot of what we discussed here, but it's really getting at and helping people understand, okay, we have a problem. You know, chronic diseases are 75%, as I said before, 75% of our healthcare costs are due to chronic illness. And I sort of explain that even from a child perspective, you know, that we have a problem. So I set that up in the beginning. And then I take people through how our food has changed through industrialized agriculture, how the food industry has impacted that over the last 30 or 40 years, as well as how food is marketed to children and how that has changed and how that has impacted families throughout the past 30 or 40 years as well. So there's a whole chapter designed to address those topics. Then I look back and I talk a little bit about just how what we've learned from some of our ancient ancestors and their traditional diets, and what truths we can pull from that. I think because in my nutrition education, you know, as a clinical nutritionist, these are not concepts, which is kind of shocking. These are not concepts that I was introduced to back in the 90s. But as I started reading all different articles, I realized, you know, this is a sort of an essential tool, because if you think about the last 30 years where we've been so misguided with, you know, the low-fat, high-carb era, you know, our answers really lie in a lot of these ancestral practices. I mean, the answers are there for us. We just got to look for it and understand them. I took some time to write about that. And then I explored epigenetics and how our genes really respond to food and the environment. And, you know, Dr. Randy Jertl, I don't know how many years ago now, when he did the experiment with agouti mice, really, I think, catapulted nutrition to, you know, rock star status, because it put nutrition on the playing field and said nutrients play an enormously important role in that push-pull relationship in the body to support a healthy gene expression. So I talk about that a little bit. And then I discuss the microbiome. I have two chapters on the microbiome, because I just think the microbiome and feeding and nourishing and nurturing your microbiome is probably one of the most essential tools for optimal health. So I talk a lot about that. And then, of course, I talk about food for your tribe. A lot of what we've just discussed here today, and I go through all macronutrients, carbohydrate, protein, and fat. I hopefully dispel some of the myths that are out there today and help empower people to choose how to choose the best products, I think, because when we enter a grocery store, you know, we have all of these crazy questions that enter our heads. You know, we don't know, should we avoid GMOs? Should we avoid the bisphenol A in the can? Should we always buy organic chicken? Should we avoid soy? Like, there's a lot of questions out there. So I try to dispel some of that in the food chapter. And then the next chapter is addressing your family's toxic body burden. And this is where I get into how the environmental toxins have influenced our health. And this is a really big one. And I felt this was really an important piece to add to the book because of how much we've changed and how our, you know, how our foods are being contaminated with glyphosate and how that plays such a big role in our health. So I dive into that and give a lot of recommendations on how, what are ways we can do with that are within our reach that we can make changes in our homes and with our families to help improve and our toxic body burden. And then I end with parenting, really, how do we parent around eating behaviors? How do we raise children knowing that children are picky by nature? How do we raise healthy, nourished children? And talk a lot about how, what are the best approaches to take from a parenting perspective? You know, how do you introduce kids to new foods, and how do you do that at each stage in their life? And at the end, I give about 65 or so recipes that are my own that I've created throughout the past 15 years, and that I can honestly say that my kids eat them all. Yeah. But it's been through this process of parenting around food that I think we don't have a lot of education on. I think parents need to take more of a leadership role and step into the driver's seat with food. I think parents need some education in that area. So that's also a big part of the book.
Right.
So that's basically it in a nutshell.
Yeah, cool. So let's talk a little bit about the kind of like that last part, the whole parenting piece, and how do you actually deliver mm-hmm. great nutrition and mm-hmm. You know, convince kids to like things that you wouldn't expect them to like. I mean, what's the key to that? It's not adding sugar to carrots, right? I mean, how do you bring that alive? And
what are the tricks of the trade?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, it peaks and valleys. And my kids are now 15 and 13. So I have ridden the wave of watching. And I have one child that's very much a food explorer. And she has eaten, you know, everything since that I put in front of her. And she's not afraid of food. She doesn't have that fear around a lot of foods. Whereas my son is the complete opposite. He's the very cautious eater. He's the kid that if you let him, he will eat, you know, refined carbohydrate foods and junk his whole life. If you let him, right? He's just very cautious with new food. So I've had two kids with very different eating perspectives, and I look at that as a gift because I now have seen both sides of the coin, and I've tried to, and I realize, you know, every kid is different. They all have different personalities, and they're all going to approach eating in a very different way. But given that, there are some basic, you know, feeding tips that I think parents can use to help eat with their kids. And, you know, when your kids are young, and it's probably around the age of between 2 and 4 when kids start really balking at foods, because before that, they usually eat everything that you put on their tray. But it's around the time where they are diaper trained that they start realizing, wait a second, I have some control here, and I'm going to start saying no to a lot of things. But one of the first things I always tell people is try and hold off on introducing processed foods to infants and toddlers as long as you can, because real whole foods cannot compete with processed food in taste. I mean, nature simply doesn't produce foods with 5 times the salt and sugar content that addicts the human taste bud. It doesn't work that way. So the longer you expose your children to whole food, the more likely they're going to be more accepting of the textures and flavors as they grow. I see too often people giving, you know, ice cream and junk to kids that are way too young that don't need it. And it's not, you know, no one needs it, but, you know, they think they're pleasing their kids, so they're giving them the junk food, and it's just not necessary. So that's the first thing I would say. Then there's other little tricks of the trade. I think not giving your kids juice. I think juice is a big thing, especially for younger kids. Parents that say, oh, I water down the juice, or I, you know, only give it to them once a day. But if it's in the house, just think that they consume a lot more of it than parents are expressing, because juice, it in terms of glycemic load, it spikes your glucose just like a soda would. I see it as the same thing. It's empty calories, and it fills their bellies up and prevents them from eating the more nutritious foods later on at the dinner table. I also, and when I introduce new flavors and textures to kids, for example, my son loved pesto, and I would make it from my garden every summer, and I'd freeze and prepare, 20 mason jars of this. But knowing that he liked pesto, I would use that food or use that flavor to introduce him to new textures and in new foods. So, for example, when I wanted to introduce him to salmon, he wasn't a really big fan of fish, but when I put a little pesto on it, it increased his acceptance of that food. I would say that if you offer kids, flavors that they already approve of, like it doesn't have to be pesto, but guacamole, or, and pair that with other foods that they're not as familiar with, a lot of times you can get some more acceptance that way. The other things I do, like when you're introducing vegetables, that's not usually high on the priority list of children, but soup is a great way, I think, to introduce vegetables to kids, because usually most kids like chicken broth, and if you can do something in that flavor combination, they're more accepting of vegetables from that perspective. One thing that I've done with my kids is another thing, is I always serve healthy foods first. And whenever I'm making dinner, I serve up an appetizer of the vegetables, and because I always want to make sure they're getting the nutrients in them first. Because if I serve my kids steak and mashed potatoes and broccoli, they're going to go for the mashed potatoes first, and they're going to eat, and the broccoli's going to sit there at the end. Yeah. So I always serve up the healthiest foods, and a lot of times my kids are so hungry they want to eat their arm off. And when I'm preparing a food, I'll give them, use hunger as, you leverage hunger, and I think that's a big one. Too often, parents are handing snacks out to kids all day long, and so it's keeping them just satiated enough where they're not really that hungry for the meal, and they'll ride the meal out because they know that, I'm not hungry enough. I'll just ask mom for ice cream at 8 o'clock at night, and I'll just skip dinner.
Right.
Kids are smart. I mean, kids know how to manipulate the system, but I think hunger is really important. I mean, it engages our natural taste cues and hunger cues that we really need to use that to your advantage. Let kids get hungry. They're not going to die. You can let them get hungry enough, even, before meals, and they're going to have food acceptance is going to be that much greater when you let them get hungry.
Yeah. What do you do about the...
I have a lot of them. I could go on and on.
What do you do about the lure of items, like snack items, if you will, like, Swedish fish,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
Yeah.
You can't hide it. I mean, you just try to figure out it in moderation. And actually, what does moderation and balance mean these days? I mean, your kids leave.
I hate that term.
Yeah, right.
because everybody has a different definition of what moderation is.
Yeah.
Does that mean I eat it, once a day or once a month? Like,
right.
People don't even know what moderation means. So... Snacking is huge from a kid's perspective because oftentimes it accounts for like two-thirds of the calories that kids are getting in a day.
Yeah.
So if you think about it from that perspective, that is enormous.
Yeah.
So I think I tell parents all the time, if you don't buy it and it's not in the house, kids are not going to be tempted by it.
Yeah.
And you need to also implement like ask before you snack rule, because if you have all this junk in your pantry and the kids are just going crazy in the pantry, they're going to pull out the Doritos and the Goldfish crackers and candy and any junk food. They're going to find it. So if you're not buying it, it's not in the house. And it's not just the kids that benefit. It's the whole family that benefits from that.
Right.
And it's not saying you can't give them some treats here and there. But I'm always thinking about nutrient density. Even in babies, we give them Cheerios and teething crackers, and we give them these refined carbohydrate foods as snacks. But in my opinion, I think, and I have recipes for this in my book, but I would give them things like sweet potato pancakes that are homemade with healthy fats for their brain health and for growth. And these are great little finger foods, pincher finger foods that they could eat. So you can make snacks very healthy. And, especially kids that are more grazers, you can really got to think of it, again, in terms of nutrient density.
Right. Yeah, great. So, both with your professional training and experiences with the book, you have given us some insights on lifestyle balances as an improvement. And if we get that right, then we can avoid using nutrition as therapeutic in terms of trying to fix a problem. If you can avoid it,
mm-hmm.
It's even better and easier, right? Any last recommendations or key highlights or suggestions on this continuum of lifestyle to therapeutic use of nutrition and how to minimize the therapeutic approach and maximize a healthy lifestyle? I mean, does it start at 6 months old and then parents need to continue to reinforce it throughout life?
It starts when the baby's in the belly.
Yeah.
Starts in pregnancy. I wish all pregnant moms really had this information before the baby's even born, because a lot happens in utero that I think is really, really important from a development perspective. And that plays into, again, eating nutrient-dense foods. And, you know, there are actually studies that are done that a lot of children that have shown that a lot of children's eating preferences come from a lot of what mom is eating while the baby's in the womb. So I think it's very, very interesting. So, you know, go eat the Indian food with turmeric and go eat a wide variety of foods, because it's absolutely influencing, you know, your child. As well as, again, very important would be to avoid a lot of these foods with environmental toxins like glyphosate and things like that. I think are very, very important for the health and growth of kids.
Well, thanks, Nicole. We're with Nicole Magrida, author of Nourish Your Tribe and clinical nutritionist and dietitian. Thanks for your insights. Your book will be available on our site called holisticmatters.com. And so we'll invite our listeners to go online and take a look and learn more about your book and what they can do to be more effective at improving lifestyles through healthy nutrition. Nicole, thanks very much for your time today. It's great talking to you as always, and we look forward to ongoing discussions and learning more from your book and seminars. Thanks.
Well, great. Thank you, John. Thank you. I look forward to it.
Right, great. Thanks.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and family. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we're talking about being the you that nature intended.